protect Americans from an attack, which could have been an attack from happening in the first place. And you bet when we capture terrorist leaders, we are going to seek to find out information that will protect attacks, that prevent attacks from happening in the first place. But we have an obligation to do so. Our military knows this. All people within the United States government know this. We have an obligation to do so in a way that is consistent with our laws and values. Now, the people that you're bringing up, you're talking about in the context, and I think it's important for the American people to know, are people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Abu Zubaydah, Ramzi Bin al-Sheib. These are dangerous killers.
So they're all killed.
Ask for an exemption on torture. Simple question.
No. And we have not. That's what I told you at the beginning.
You want to preserve the ability to use tougher tactics with those individuals who you mentioned, right?
Well, obviously you have a different view from the American people. I think the American people understand the importance of doing everything within our power and within our laws to protect the American people.
Well, what is it that you want the CIA to be able to do that the U.S. armed forces are not allowed to do?
Yeah, I'm not going to get into talking about national security matters, Bill. I don't do that because this involves information that relates to doing all we can to protect the American people. And if you have a different view, obviously some of you on this room, in this room, have a different view. Some of you on the front row have a different view.
What did the Vice President?
It's spelled out in our statement of administration policy in terms of what our views are. That's very public information. In terms of our discussions with members of Congress, in terms of our members, I will discuss.
It must be tough to be a talking head for the swine of the society, for the ruling order, for the administrators for the ruling order, like Boy George and Cheney and Rumsdale and all those others that you play your crony game to. You talk about how you're going to do what's consistent to protect people, guided by our laws and our values. Well, your American values has exposed itself to hundreds of years of lynching of black, capital punishment of teenagers, capital punishment of innocents, capital punishment in general. And then you have the nerve to talk about torture as if this is something that you believe that we will swallow, that your empire does not engage in, while John Burge is a cat fisherman / torturer from the Chicago Police Department. Please, it is Smiggy time. Check it out. Listening to 103.3, 101.1, freakradio.org with Skid in Santa Cruz, 107.5, North Carolina, LUVER.com, the world, radioforall.net, the universe, Upstart Radio, and click in to the slave web. Let's go Slave Revolt Radio, find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to explore how the privatization of death in all of its most militaristic forms is as American as lynching and torture. So all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3, Slave Revolt.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see, with the God, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. past with planets in the solar system.
And kicked around for at least a century among scientists. And most, what I call hard-nosed scientists, say, of course not. It's obviously absurd.
Ah, you know what time it is now. Beyond the Shadow. And tonight, you know, as the vice grip of the privatized market order squeezes the masses relentlessly, the rulers need various forms of repression to maintain their order. And it's becoming more and more clear that from Baghdad to New Orleans, privatized mercenaries are slithering into our living grounds. In this Beyond the Shadow segment called Killers for Hire, World for Sale, we're about to explore the dynamics of this construct. Ken Silverstein, author of the book Private Warriors, goes into some of these modern origins of these mercenary firms. So let's explore some of this machine of death apparatus. Check it out.
Well, The first of these firms got started 20 years ago. A firm called Vanel began training the Saudi army 20, 25 years ago. But the whole trend has intensified with the end of the Cold War. The military budget remains roughly at Cold War levels in real terms. But there's been a huge downsizing of the Cold War bureaucracy. And so you've had tens of thousands of people pushed out of the Cold War apparatus, the bureaucratic apparatus. And here I'm talking about generals and gun runners and CIA agents. A lot of these people have been moved or forced to move into the private sector, and the skills they have to offer are military and paramilitary skills. Now, these military training firms that have sprung up, and the best example is Military Professional Resources, Inc. It's based in Alexandria, Virginia. It's a couple of dozen former 3 and 4 star generals founded the firm about, I think it was in the early 90s, and they offer training programs to foreign armies. This is something that used to be exclusively the work of the Pentagon, but now you've got these private firms doing it. There are a couple of problems with this from my point of view. One is that with private firms you have very little congressional oversight, and you have very little public scrutiny. I mean, a retired general doesn't have to even speak to the press if he doesn't want to, whereas a general is more or less obliged to publicly discuss American policies and what he might be doing in a given country. MPRI has been contracted in a variety of places around the globe. They have trained the army of Croatia, of Bosnia. They're working with this new African crisis response initiative that President Clinton put together a rapid strike force in Africa. They are reportedly moving into Colombia and Nigeria. There are reports of that. It's hard to know exactly because the government doesn't have to tell you what MPRI is doing. After all, it's just a private firm. Now, it's worth pointing out here that this is a private firm that is licensed only by the State Department, and so, in my view, it's more or less an extension of foreign policy. It's a proxy for our government. We use private firms because there's greater secrecy, and we can continue to influence events around the world, and yet we don't have to take responsibility. Again, the fingerprints aren't really there if it's just a private company.
All right, so you can see what is happening. And what's interesting about Brunel is that Brunel actually got his start as a cutout for the CIA during the Vietnam War. As one CIA official said, that Brunel is our, quote, own little mercenary army. So this is all of this cutout cloak and dagger type stuff so that they could avoid reporting some of the clandestine operations that they have going on throughout the world. And now, within the advancement of the privatization of the planet, these guys, like in Brunel's case, have spun off into their own little private firm. So they're just mercenaries for hire, and now they're training the Praetorian Guard for the Saudi Arabia royal family. So this is how this whole process is developing in a way where the elites are hiring their own mercenary task force to do their various missions of oppression, and it helps serve the various governments where many of these mercenary operation groups are coming from to hide under the veneer that it's not their government per se, or their official military that's carrying out these operations. But as Silverstein pointed out, we know that they're linked because you have to get a license of approval by the State Department before you're able to accept these particular contracts overseas. So this is basically terrorism, coup, assassination by proxy. Now, within that same context, you can see how also, as the old line families in New Orleans are using their various mercenary firms, Blackwaters and others, to carry out internally their deeds of control by violence, by force, of against the desired population to maintain order and protection. Blackwater and others are a form of Praetorian Guard for the old line families in New Orleans, in the same way that Brunel is assisting as being the trainers for the Praetorian Guard of the royal family. I mean, this might as well be like the, you know, 1600s, you know, where royal elite families just raw and ruthlessly have their knights in armor protect their interests and stuff. At the same time, a wretched government like this, one in the United States, can hide under plausible deniability. And it all helps wrap the country further in the cloak of secrecy. So secret government apparatus are taking place, the whole secret state, as it molds and corrodes the basic humanity and lifeblood out of humanity internally and externally. Now next, let's listen how Silverstein goes into how the South African mercenary firm, formerly known as Executive Outcomes, has a quite interesting record. in their field of killers for hire in a world for sale. Check it out.
Executive Outcomes was really a rent-an army. I mean, you actually could hire a division, you could hire planes and pilots. And they fought in Angola, sort of bizarrely. The South African government during the apartheid years fought against the government of Angola because it was a left-wing regime that supported Nelson Mandela. Later on, Executive Outcomes actually came in and fought on the side of the Angolan government against Savimbi, who they had previously been allied with. So you had South African troops fighting its previous allies because they were paid good money for the contract. In fact, they were reportedly got diamond concessions and also this is how the Savimbis paid for the services, apparently with diamonds. So MPRI doesn't actually send in troops. They send in trainers. They train people to go out and do the fighting themselves. So there is a distinction here that I think it's worth pointing out. But they basically are, the MPRI and these other firms go in and provide the training that allows these countries to go out and do what they need to do on their own. Another example is in Saudi Arabia, where a company called Vanel, which is now owned by TRW, has been training the Saudi National Guard for more than 20 years. And that's basically a Praetorian Guard. It protects important economic installations. It protects the royal family. And, of course, the Saudis have one of the world's worst human rights record. I'm not sure it's a good idea to have a private American company over there instructing the Praetorian Guard of the Saudi royal family in fending off any threat to its rule there.
So once again, you have a situation of, let's follow how this process develops in market economies and in a marketized world. Executive Outcomes was basically a part of the armed apparatus of the South African apartheid government. So basically, they fought in their particular interests, similar to how a wing or a branch or a battalion of the U.S. Army would fight for over in Iraq right now. But the South African apartheid government is quote-unquote disbanded. So now these guys have all of their training, and they're still in a market society. South Africa is still a market society based in it. The regions around the world are still based in a market society, and they have a usefulness in those types of mercenary type skilled performers. So they form their little private firm, which just goes right along with their little marketing interest after apartheid quote-unquote disbands. And hey, their skills that they have to offer are wanted. So they end up in a situation where at one time, see, South Africa was trying to pulverize the whole southern region of Southern Africa under its apartheid stage. After it got whipped up with the help of Cuba and other entities, they had to retreat. South African apartheid officially disbands. So now these guys dismarket themselves and now come in on the side of the government of Angola to help fight against the people that they were in alignment with, which was Savimbi at one time. So this is just perpetuating this type of war, chaos, destruction, so on and so forth. And from the standpoint of marketing, these guys did a quote-unquote profitable and acceptable thing. this is how sick this process is. And the people who benefit, of course, are the arms sellers, the arm dealers, the merchants of misery who go into areas that are destabilized and help rape the land of its resources as people are left in a fragile state. So in Angola, which has the highest amputee rate per capita in the world, is prime to have its diamonds and other things ripped off. Now what's also interesting is Vanel. I went into a second ago about how they were cut out of the CIA, but now in this privatized time in development, and it should be seen in the context that part of the reason why there are more firms or the privatization situation is happening within the mercenary industry is similar to how they're privatizing electricity, energy, water, etc. In other words, it's an expansion of the growing power of a ruling elite order in all of its forms. So the mercenary aspect is just another form of that expansion of control and terror and death. In the same way that you see, you know, the pharmaceutical companies grow and expand and patent with more influence and so on and so forth. So Vernell is instructing the Praetorian Guard to protect the royal family's rule over there. Now, you can see how they would get the okay by the State Department to do this, because after all, as we went in a couple of shows ago on the energy base show, Roosevelt was got the word about the decline of U.S. petroleum internally, the U.S. production of petroleum. The U.S. was the Saudi Arabia at one time, but it was projected to run out, which is already past its peak. When I say run out, I mean past its peak and no longer be a distributor of oil, petroleum throughout the world, but have to import it in. That's when Roosevelt and company made the deal with the Saudis. They had no real contact with the Saudis at the time. And as mentioned a couple of shows ago, the Saudis, this Saudi royal member who had dragged along his little slaves in meeting with Roosevelt, had no problem with this deal. And at that point, that's when the collaboration has been joint with the U.S. Empire and the Saudis. So there is an interest, a financial interest, an imperial interest, a material interest for the imperialists to want to sustain the royal family over in Saudi Arabia. So it's quite natural for them to allow their mercenary outfits and other outfits to be able to go over there and serve and train the Praetorian Guard over in Saudi Arabia. At the same time, it was within the Carter Doctrine, and all of them have said this, you know, once alignment had been made with Saudi Arabia, from Truman to Eisenhower. But in the Carter Doctrine, which he stated at the State of the Union January 23rd, 1980, Carter, Jimmy Carter, president, said this, quote, "Let our position be absolutely clear. An attempt by any outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on a vital interest of the United States of America, and such an assault will be repelled by any means necessary, including military force," unquote. So in other words, what they were basically saying, the empire was saying, is that anyone who tries to disrupt our influence and our interest, which is tied into the energy source in that region, will be met with maximum violence. And this tradition has gone on ever since. There's nothing different than what Jimmy Carter or what Roosevelt laid out than the strategy that the big oil or the neocons or any of these others who are the petroleum guard for the ruling elite class in America. So is how the whole thing works. And as a matter of fact, you know, when the U.S. bond to Saudi Arabia is so tight that as others have talked about, in essence, a threat to the royal Saudi family's interest is basically a threat to the ruling order's interest. So this is how, like, when the neocons went too far, in a sense. In other words, remember, it wasn't just the neocons that had plans for the invasion into Iraq. Actually, for years and all throughout the crime Bill Clinton administration, they were basically following the doctrines of Big Oil and the State Department, which was the State Department outlined by Big Oil wanted a coup. They wanted to replace Saddam Hussein with someone within you know, his own unit, someone within the Ba'ath Party, so on and so forth. They didn't want too much disruption, a coup, maybe close down the government for a day or two, but get things right back and running. Not a lot of chaos and shooting and, you know, civil war, of course, and all of that, because that hinders the flow and could be a hindrance on their control of the resource that they're after. And all through those years, Crime Bill was basically using various strategies to undermine Saddam Hussein. In other words, within that context, you can see how the sanctions were used to try to destabilize Saddam, hopefully get someone within the Ba'ath Party, a general or whoever, to lead a coup and overthrow Saddam so that the sanctions would be downgraded. The whole no-fly zone that the U.S. made up was all part of that terroristic apparatus. They had bombings go on within the region by little infiltrators that they had in. This kind of a mercenary type of outfit. As a matter of fact, Crime Bill, the same day that he had a number of people from a number of states, including Arab states, talk about in this, like, meeting about decrying terrorism and the use of terrorism, was the same day that a bombing took place by one of these aligned with the U.S. Empire type mercenary type groups, exposing the hypocrisy of it all. But my whole point is that Saddam was too deeply embedded and had a network that was too tightly woven for the U.S. to penetrate and have him assassinated or know specifically which Saddam was the right Saddam. So, as John Perkins has pointed out in Confessions of the Economic Hitman, when the jackals can't get what they want accomplished for the ruling order through that method, then they'll have to just draw back and go into the next mode of operation. And the next mode of operation is basically the military, this raw dog going in. Now, of course, that's a little bit more, it exposes them a little bit more. It puts things a little bit too in focus, too raw. And it can often bring about more outwardly discontent amongst the population, especially if there is any kind of semi-high casualty rate amongst the American population that's engaged in the imperial struggle. But that's basically what happened. After the strategies outlined by Big Oil had been attempted for over a decade, could not be accomplished, they went into the next mode, which is right in alignment with Perkins and others, outlined how the strategy plays out, and that was to raw dog go in with a military force. Now, at that point, the neocons thought they had seized the time because their own particular goal within this privatized construct of control of the world is basically, well, look, now we can crush OPEC, which would weaken even more the Arab states, and bring Saudi Arabia to its knees by the fact that now we have control over Iraq's oil resources. We won't allow them to have us go by the quotas amount of how much you pump per day. We'll just sell it off to all of our different friends, have them own different regions privately, Shalabi, so on and so forth. All these cronies, everyone turn the spigot up, it will flood the market, OPEC will crash, the Saudis will crash, and Israel will become more of a prominent entity in the region. Neocon strategy. The problem was that that strategy would cut into Big Oil's profitability, because Big Oil's making the most profits it's ever had out of that whole construct of the OPEC and alignment with Saudi Arabia. And that's how and when you saw Big Oil come in, slap all the neocons aside. Cheney got in line, and now he's one of the biggest proponents, after he got straightened out, that no, we're not going to break it up to little fiefdoms. It's going to still be state controlled. They're not going to leave OPEC. It's going to follow the quotas in Iraq, and so on and so forth. Chalabi, once he got disciplined right, he's come back into the picture, but he too now believes that Iraq should stay within OPEC and not be broken out into many, you know, different regions of privatized cells and all. In other words, they all got disciplined properly. So this helps show and connect how the whole privatization model works and how many of these guys can have different particular interests that drive them the most. But at the end of the day, it's all within the market system and the captains of industry's hands. Next, Silverstein points out that this global privatized mercenary jihad phenomenon is taking place rapidly, day by day. Check it out.
This is a global phenomenon, I would point out. There are Israeli firms, there are South African firms, there are British companies training the, you know, army battalions over in Colombia to protect pipeline installations. So you've got companies all around the world. There was an Israeli firm that was caught training a Colombian drug lord. They were instructing the Colombian drug lord's thugs in assassination. And so this is the sort of thing that to me is quite scary. When you have the privatization of military training, I think these sorts of abuses are much more likely, because there is no oversight. If there's no oversight, if you operate in the shadows, then, gee, you know.
All right, now this helps expose how, you know, in many ways, they're playing us like fools. Because here you have an Israeli firm training a Colombian drug cartel. Now, at the same time, Israel is supposed to be, quote-unquote, helping out Sam in his war on drugs in Latin America. So, this is all just a farce And it just shows how they're playing in to people's stereotypes, racism, and complicity in this whole setup. Especially on top of that, you have a situation where, like, Celerino Castillo, he's the author of the book Powder Burn, former DEA agent, who outlined in his book and in his documents how cocaine was being flown out of Oliver North's little setup, out of the Ilopano Air Base. And this was done to be sold to help fund the Contras. Yet at the same time, Sam was over there pretending that he was fighting the Sandinistas to stop drug dealing and terrorism. Even though at the end of the day, the people in Nicaragua took Sam to court for international terrorism, where Sam was found guilty and told to pay in world court $19 billion. Of course, Sam didn't, because he's just this, you know, a common international thug that just does what he wants, at least at this present time. But this whole thing helps highlight also that if you don't fight this terrorist government and its policies full throttle, without any illusion about Democrats or Republicans or any of that nonsense, these same policies may wash up on your shore one day, like in New Orleans, like with Blackwater. It's all tied together. Now next, here's Silverstein once again talking about how the private mercenaries get approval. In other words, how they get their license from the State Department on a particular contract. So let's check this out.
Well, these companies are licensed by the State Department, so they don't do anything that is not formally approved by the U.S. government. And so if the U.S. government had approved training of the Serbs, which is very unlikely, they wouldn't have, they would no doubt have gone in and done it, but I suspect the license would have been rejected. So, yes, there is oversight in the sense that this is done with the complicity of government officials, but there's no public oversight. And that's exactly why, you know, I would put it to your listeners. How many of your listeners heard about an American company training the Croatian army? Maybe a few of them have, but most people I know were not aware of the fact that you had and, you know, a company made up of retired generals over there training the Croatian army. How many of them know that that same company is training the government, the army troops in Bosnia now, or that they are reportedly in Nigeria and Colombia? It's something that operates below the radar screen because there's no congressional oversight. Congress could review it, but because, first off, the foreign governments themselves pay for the training. Secondly, because I don't think there's anyone in government who's particularly keen to bring this to the attention of Congress. Thirdly, if the U.S. government is paying for it itself and the contract is under $14 million, then I believe there's no congressional oversight at all, and some of these contracts are smaller than that. For all of these reasons, there's really been no public debate about this subject. The Pentagon, as we all know, is never particularly eager to hold press conferences and be called to account about anything. No government agency is dying to talk about what it's doing domestically or abroad. I mean, government officials like to operate quietly. That's perfectly understandable. But when you're contracting out the work, it allows the government to do that much more effectively. You don't have to take responsibility for it. And one thing I found in researching this book is that because these companies are private firms, I filed Freedom of Information Act requests to the State Department and other government agencies about their activities. That's, I'm sure most of your listeners know this, but as a reporter or even as a private citizen, you can request information from government agencies about their activities, etc. In the case of MPRI, I asked for information and I was told it's proprietary. It's private business information, hence they're exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. And so, again, that just enhances the ability of the government to operate in secrecy.
So, once again, we see a situation where, when Silverstein talks about how a company has to be, or firm, mercenary firm, has to be licensed by the State Department before they can take the contract, that how this is tied into the whole corporate state apparatus. So in other words, hypothetically, the black folks of the western part of the Sudan, the Darfurians, or the black folks from the Nuba Mountains, the Nubas, or the Furs, or the Dinkas in the south, or any of the other true Nubians of that region, wanted to hire one of these firms to help fight against the Christopher Columbuses with turbans on, we know this wouldn't be allowed, because these National Islamic Front terrorists, the Christopher Columbuses with turbans, beards, and hijabs, they're friends with Sam. So Sam is going to protect his friends in the same way that they let Aristide have his little protection racket with Blackwater go on for a while. But you remember, right before they carted Aristide out of the country, they told Blackwater to come on home. Blackwater, you know, want the same mercenary group that is over in New Orleans right now, and had a couple of his members burnt up in Iraq. And what did Blackwater do? They came on home. And Aristide got shipped on out of home. Now, this also highlights, though, that, see, the freedom struggle for oppressed people is not aligning yourself with these privatized mercenary outfits in any form, because they don't have your interest. They don't have your outlook of the world. They're mercenaries. They're little henchmen. They're just thugs for hire. And the same way that they cloak themselves in secrecy and play their cloak and dagger games, at a moment's notice, they could thrust that dagger into your back. Now, another aspect that's going on is that you have a situation where a number of military personnel are talking about how this type of situation is going to expand, as one department Office of a Defense Trade Control said in this quote-unquote emerging field that, quote, the private training programs are designed to further our foreign policy objectives. If the government doesn't sanction it, the companies don't do it, unquote. So this exposes how this is linked into the imperialist interests, from Baghdad to Haiti to New Orleans. Aristide in many ways was a fool hiring these guys. I mean, first of all, why would they really be over there? He was kidnapped by the U.S. government years before, and then he's going to turn to the same government and its mercenary operations for protection. They were just doing an intel on them. There's no doubt in my mind that they were giving intel information back to the proper authorities, because that's in part who they serve. Another aspect is you know, there's been a long list of these thugs in this. You know, Che came up against Mike Hoare, you know, from the Fifth Command. He was one of these legendary mercenaries who was plunging the Congo, you know, in alignment with Shambi and Mobutu, which basically devastated the Congo, and then by effect through the African liberation movement that was going on in the early 60s off kilter. by the time Che and other Afro-Cubans came down to the region of the Congo to fight off all of these mercenaries there, it was already too late. Actually, I'm going to do a thing on that particular, now that I think about it, to get specific on the issues of how that event helped change the course of what was happening in Africa, and how Africa and Congo have been locked within that imperialist grip since. But next, let's go into Silverstein as he goes into a conversation he had with Bob Brown. This dude's the editor of the mercenary magazine Soldiers of Fortune that started in 1975. And basically, you can get it any newsstand, even like Tower Records. They have, in their book section, they had the Soldiers of Fortune and, all their little latest escapades and stuff that they promote. So let's check out what Silverstein has to say.
Spoke to Bob Brown, the editor of Soldier of Fortune magazine, and he said that he more or less approved of this trend, and he favored actually an even more explicit type of situation where you'd have an American equivalent of the French Foreign Legion, because he said, basically every time an American soldier gets killed abroad, some fairy, I believe is the term he used, goes running around complaining that we shouldn't have American troops fighting overseas, but with these sorts of firms, if somebody gets killed, it's just too bad. You don't have some mother complaining about her poor dead son. And so this is his view on the situation, is that we should have more of this, because that way it doesn't create a stink and we can still continue to send our troops abroad without raising political objections at home.
So, once again, this is in part possibly an aspect of why Boy George and Company were resistant towards adding more troops on the field for control of the Iraqi region once they drove their way into Iraq. They're such committed privatizers, and they want to privatize, under this kind of Grover Northquist model, the world up, internally and externally, so bad that even though many of the more high-ranking imperial generals were saying that the U.S. Empire should have 300,000 to 400,000 boots on the ground, they were resistant to it. Yet we saw an influx of mercenary outfits coming in, but they resisted adding more G.I. Joes, from the regular military in. Now, part of it, I think, it had to do with part of a shortage, and they didn't want to get in a situation where they even had to contemplate the draft. But another aspect may be part of their whole ideological bent, where they're just so committed in ramping down the regular military and ramping up the mercenary force for their own Praetorian Guard outlook. So their own privatized ideology may have conflicted with their own imperialist pragmatism, fortunately, because now the quagmire that they're in is something that we wish it to be in. Now, that also aligns itself in part with, from like 1985 to 1999, the U.S. military, which had built up to 800,000, was downgraded to around 480,000. So you see that whole apparatus take place, especially at the end of the Cold, quote-unquote. Supposedly the end of the Cold War. There's other aspects to their so-called Cold War. Another thing, though, that this highlights is that, on the very first cover, if you check out these Army of Fortune magazines and their documents and, you know, stuff on the web and whatever, their very first cover of the Soldier of Fortune magazine that came out in 75, you'll see that it had a cover of a mercenary, a Soldier of Fortune mercenary, with an African male with a bullet in his head. The dude was somewhere in Africa. And the reason why I mention this off, this was in 75. And by then, the Panthers had pretty much collapsed. And other black organizations with international outlooks and outreach. And with the collapse of the Panthers and other radical internationalist type groups, also went a lot of the a radical international perspective that black people were engaged in on a political level, because many of the civil rights types, Negroes and stuff, remember, when you research the stuff that, like, Malcolm was doing in the early 60s, right before he was assassinated, like when he went throughout Africa and stuff, the civil rights Negroes were sending people right behind him, telling the various African heads of states and others that America wasn't treating black people that bad, and you can make deals with Sam and all of that, while Malcolm was in Ghana and other places, saying, don't trust Sam. He doesn't have your interest. And even though he wasn't one of the quote-unquote official colonialists, he was one of the great official kidnappers of your people out of the continent. So he's in the same bag as Britain and the rest of them. So don't fall for his tricks. But by the time many of the Panther-like groups collapsed by the mid-70s, you saw the emergence of a reassessment, take another twofold a grip after the collapse of the Congo in the mid-60s take place, as John Stockwell goes into in his book, In Search of Enemies, how he, as a CIA ranking official, dove head deep into the Angolan affair at the behest of the CIA to disrupt and help destroy that movement and process. So once again, what is affecting us nationally plays a role of international outcomes. Here, Silverstein goes into players in this privatized war game, like Frank Gaffney, and how he's lobbied all kinds of aspects for this perpetual war economy. Check it out.
Gaffney, for example, clearly influences policy. He's a guy who formerly served in the Pentagon during the Reagan years. He was one of the most ardent hardliners during the Reagan years. He was an early champion of the whole idea of Star Wars, by which the United States is supposed to construct an astrodome that is going to defend us against any sort of ballistic missile attack from abroad. Now, we've sunk $60 billion and counting into that program so far, and we've got nothing to show for it. Test after test, the Pentagon has failed to shoot down an incoming ballistic missile. So it's, in my view, an enormous waste of money. It's just one of the great boondoggles of our times. Gaffney has, after retiring from the Reagan administration, went out and formed the Center for National Policy and in Washington, D.C. And this is an organization that is funded by by defense contractors that have an enormous stake in Star Wars, Lockheed, Boeing, Northrop. He gets money from all of these companies that that basically have huge stake in the continuation of this program. And Gaffney then goes out and has lobbied very hard. He's probably the most effective and earnest advocate for Star Wars, what's now been somewhat downgraded, but to the ballistic missile defense program. And so here you have a case where you've got a private warrior who is definitely influencing our national security policy.
So once again, you see how this whole thing, these privatizers, they're just bankrupters. They don't add anything to society except more and more destruction, chaos, death, mayhem. $60 billion down the drain for this Star Wars program. It's just corporate welfare based on a destructive model. Money that could have been in a humane society and world used for expansion and development on living energy systems, solar, wind, etc. But see, the privatized model of death is not based in that or a living energy system. It's based in the killers for hire in a world for sale. Now here, Silverstein outlines how it's hard to follow the money because of the private corporate privacy tricks played out by these killer mercenaries.
I heard about him because I heard of a lawsuit between him and another American arms dealer. And to make a long story short, through that lawsuit, I learned of a number of people who he had worked with in government and out, and I was able to find out quite a bit of information about Glatt. It turns out that he is a very right-wing German who started working with the U.S. government 30, 40 years ago, and he pulled off some of the more sensational operations of the Cold War period and beyond. He specialized in secretly buying Soviet bloc weaponry. He'd go around bribing Soviet bloc officials in order to buy their weapons. And then we would take those weapons and send them to our allies. So during the 80s, for example, Glatt helped supply the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and the Contras in Nicaragua. He armed them both with Polish weapons, ironically enough. He bought this stuff straight out of the Polish armory and helped ship it to our allies and anti-communist allies in the Third World. So Glatt may be the most important arms dealer of the latter half of the 20th century, a private arms dealer. And he specialized, of course, he's not, Lockheed doesn't need help selling its F-16. And Northrop doesn't need help selling its V-2. Glatt specialized in smaller stuff in the case of arming our Third World allies. And he bought a number of very big systems from the Soviet Union, anti-aircraft systems, helicopters, this sort of stuff that he sent to the Pentagon for testing requirements. And so, to me, that was the most exciting chapter of the book because it truly was unknown history.
So here you have a situation where this arms dealer, Ernest Werner Glatt, is buying Soviet bloc weapons to feed the Contras and to feed the Mujahideen. And how this all fits within the whole privatization model for death and control and sales. If you can sell the right stuff to the right mercenaries, to the right wretched regime for the right price, of course it's all good for the U.S. empire. And it just perpetuates this whole marketeer. These guys are marketeers of death and destruction. That's how he bases his whole life in. You know, he's up there kicking it, living in Nelson County in Virginia, nice and comfortable, while he markets death throughout the planet. But in this market-type system that's based in privatized and control of people's lives and the disposal of it, it's all good. Now here's Silverstein as he outlines the aspect of how private corporations play out the privacy game by their killer mercenary firms. Check it out.
Well, I tried very hard to find a precise figure, and this is, again, one of the problems when this is done privately. The government is not obliged to give out certain information, and a lot of this information is simply hidden in the ledger sheets of the companies themselves. So I cannot tell you how much money is actually involved. I can tell you that the trend is growing. Everyone agrees that it's growing. A couple of years ago, in fact, the Defense Intelligence Agency, a sort of sister agency to the CIA, held a conference at a luxury hotel in Virginia where a lot of these firms got together to discuss about the increasing privatization of security in Africa and opportunities for these firms. So I know it's a growing field. I cannot put a dollar figure on it. I wish I could.
So once again, as Silverstein was outlining, this whole thing is so wrapped up in secrecy because of this whole, they're a corporation. So the regular freedom of information type stuff, they can kick it to the curb. Yet at the same time, it's the State Department that hands out the license. And as I've noted, you had various officials just come out and say that it's these guys are doing what's in the state's interest and that you're going to see more of it. So it's with the endorsement of the state, but they're using the whole cloak of being a corporate firm to hide under privacy. Yet at the same time, they're crushing our privacy daily as well as our lives. So as we tie this all up in this killers for hire, world for sale construct with the secrecy that this empire is using to cloak itself within the shadow and hide its terrorism and its terrorism intelligence abroad and within these shores. Here's a report on the spying that this terroristic society is doing, basically for neutralization purposes down the road, orchestrated through by the FBI, all under the auspices of it being an act of patriotism. In reality, it's a psyops game. Check it out.
All right, well, sometime this summer, two FBI agents showed up in Windsor, Connecticut, and they found a guy named George Christian. They handed him a letter. It said two things. It said, give us all the records you have on whoever was using a particular computer in your system. And it said, do not disclose to any person ever that you received this letter.
And the system was in a local library, right? This was a company that sort of, what, provides security for computers in libraries?
It provides data services for about 36 Connecticut public libraries, circulation records, internet access, email, and so on.
So what kind of information, if this company, if this Mr. Christian had complied, what kind of information would the government have gotten about people who use that particular computer?
Well, it depends how the order was interpreted. At minimum, the government would have received for each of those people who use the computer, where they browse on the web, what searches they'd sent to Google, what email accounts they opened, and probably to whom they sent email or received email from.
Now, what other kinds of institutions are getting letters like these, and how many are there?
Well, in the last year for which account was collected, and I should mention this count is classified, it's not released publicly, there were about 30,000 of these letters issued. That is not a complete count. There is a category of national security letters that's not included, so there were more than that. And each letter is capable of getting the records of tens or hundreds of people. So the number of people whose records have been gathered is certainly in the hundreds of thousands. It goes to phone companies, it goes to banks, casinos, pawn shops, any broadly defined financial institution or telecommunications provider.
And now, who has the authority to issue such letters, and what standards do they have to use?
The FBI does this on its own. Since the Patriot Act, any field office special agent in charge, so there are about 60 or more FBI agents who are able to authorize these things. They don't need any review by a court. The standard is that the FBI judges the information to be quote-unquote relevant to or sought for an investigation of terrorism or counter-espionage.
All right, give us a little more sense of how wide the scope of information is. Let's say you were in email touch with a foreigner in your role as journalist that came under suspicion, and the government sent a letter of inquiry to whatever internet provider that foreigner used. What would the government get about you?
Well, first of all, if you're saying the government has demanded records pertaining to the foreigner, the government would know when I wrote email to this target, when the target wrote email to me. The government would also learn my identity, and so the government might very well use a technique called contact chaining to find out who I've been sending email to, because the government's interested in establishing networks of co-conspirators.
And then under what circumstances would the government be able to get financial information about somebody who was in a secondary position?
The standard remains the same. It's relevance. And I should emphasize what happened in the Patriot Act. Before the Patriot Act, these letters existed, but the FBI had to say that it had specific and articulable reasons to suspect that the person whose records they wanted was a terrorist or was a spy. What the Patriot Act did was say, you don't have to suspect the person of any wrongdoing. You only have to assert that the information that you want is quote-unquote relevant to, or you're seeking it for, a terrorism investigation. So once they've decided that I'm relevant to an investigation, they can get my banking records, my investment records, my gambling records, if I had any gambling records, as well as my phone and email account.
And finally, briefly, what happens to all this information? Let's say we'll take the example of you emailing with someone. It turns out there was absolutely nothing suspicious or wrong about that person. What happens to that information on you?
It's a good question, because until 2 years ago, what would happen is the FBI would be legally obliged to destroy the information once establishing that it pertained to an innocent person and was no longer relevant to their investigation. Then Attorney General John Ashcroft, in October of 2003, reversed that. He ordered that the FBI keep all records it gathers in all investigations, and he ordered that it be shared with other government agencies. And so what they're doing now is they're working on proposals or on directions to do quote-unquote data mining in this, where they sift through all the records for unseen patterns.
So here you have a situation where, once again, this little ruling order has set up a situation where they decide, in essence, who's a threat. Now, it's not going to be the CEOs or the corporations or the stockholders that are polluting the ocean, that are causing the greenhouse effect, that are pulverizing the water supply, that are creating unsafe conditions for the masses of people to work in, that are putting animals in inhumane factory farm type situations. In this privatized world, The rulers decide who's the threat. And of course, it's who and what they say are organizing or thinking in an interest or in a way that goes outside of the boundaries of what they find acceptable. This is why a lot of this stuff, in part, is not a personal type thing. When you hear people talk about how we have to, some cops are good, some cops are bad, we can't lump all soldiers or all this into one, it's not about that. It's, who are you fighting for? Shaquille O'Neal wants to be a cop. Actually, he has some kind of badge or something right now. But when he retires from basketball, he wants to be a cop. Now, Shaquille's from Louisiana. Now, if Shaquille had become a cop in Louisiana and was told to go out on that Gretna Bridge and prevent desperate, deprived, humiliated, spatially deconcentrated black people and other people who are with those black people from crossing that bridge to safety to get food, and it was your grandmother he was stopping with arms along with other cops. Your sister, your mother, your grandfather, your own brothers, your own friends, or just people in general that were just slaves in this system, and you had a means to defend yourself from that onslaught, what would you do? Regardless of the fact of Shaq supposedly having a good personality and being a good guy, I wouldn't hesitate. Squeeze that trigger. You can't be on the side of the enslaver. You can't be on the side of the flesh peddler, the privatizer, the flesh trader, and at the same time, pretend you're on the side of the slave. Hold on a sec.
CIA, Marine Corps, three CIA secret wars. I had a position in the National Security Council in 1975 as the chief of the Angola task force running the secret war in Angola. It was the third CIA secret war I was part of. The national security law creating the National Security Council and the CIA, as you know, was passed in 1947. The CIA was given this charter to perform such other duties and functions as might be necessary to the national security interest, and given a vague authority to protect its sources and methods. I think it was in the mid-80s that I coined this phrase, the Third World War, because in my research I realized that we were not attacking the Soviet Union and the CIA's activities. We were attacking people in the Third World. And I'm going to just quickly, in the interest of time, just give you a little sense of what that means, this Third World War. Basically, it's the third, I believe, in terms of loss of life and human destruction, the third bloodiest war in all of history. They undertake to run operations in every corner of the globe. They also undertook the license of operating just totally above and beyond U.S. laws. They had a license, if you will, to kill, but also they took that to a license to smuggle drugs, a license to do all kinds of things to other people and other societies in violation of international law and every principle of nations working together for a healthier and more peaceful world. Meanwhile, again, they battled to convert the U.S. legal system in such a way that it would give them control of our society. Now, we have massive documentation of what they call the secret wars of the CIA. We don't have to guess or speculate. We had the Church Committee investigate them in 1975, gave us our first really in-depth, powerful look inside this structure. Senator Church said in the 14 years before he did his investigation that he found they had run 900 major operations and 3,000 minor operations. And if you extrapolate that over the whole period of the 40-odd years that we've had a CIA, you come up with 3,000 major operations and over 10,000 minor operations. Every one of them illegal, every one of them disruptive of the lives and societies of other peoples, and many of them bloody and gory, beyond comprehension almost. Extensively, we manipulated and organized the overthrow of functioning constitutional democracies in other countries. We organized secret armies and directed them to fight in just about every continent in the world. We encouraged ethnic minorities to rise up and fight. People like the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua, the Kurds in the Middle East, the Hmongs in Southeast Asia. And of course, we have organized and we still do and fund death squads in countries around the world, like the Treasury Police in El Salvador, which are responsible for most of the killing of the 50,000 people just in the 80s, and there were 70,000 before that. And orchestration, CIA secret teams and propaganda led us directly into the Korean War. We were attacking China from the islands, Kaimoi, Matsu, Thailand, Tibet. A lot of drug trafficking involved in this, by the way, until eventually we convinced ourselves to fight the Chinese in Korea, and we had the Korean War, and 1 million people were killed. Same thing for the Vietnam War, and we have extensive documentation of how the CIA was involved at every level of the national security complex, because it's a very cooperative thing, into manipulating the nation into the Vietnam War. And we wound up creating the Golden Triangle, in which the CIA, Air America airplanes, were flying in arms to our allies and flying back out with the heroin. We launched the largest, this is something that Jimmy Carter did, Admiral Turner brags about it, the operation in Afghanistan, biggest single operation, I'm told, in the history of the CIA's secret wars. And sure enough, very quickly we produced the Golden Crescent, which is still the largest source of heroin perhaps in the world today. Trying to summarize this third world war that the CIA, the U.S. National Security Complex, with the military all interwoven in it in many different ways, has been waging. Let me just put it this way. The best heads that I coordinate with studying this thing, we count at least, minimum figure, 6 million people who've been killed in this long 40-year war that we've waged against the people of the third world. These are not Soviets. We have not been parachuting teams into the Soviet Union to kill and hurt and maim people, especially not since 1954, when they developed actually a capability of dropping atomic weapons on the United States. They aren't British, French, Swedes, Swiss, Belgians. We don't do bloody gory operations in the countries of Europe. These are all people of the third world. They're people of countries like the Congo, Vietnam, Cambodia, Indonesia, Nicaragua, where conspicuously they nor their governments do not have the capability of doing any physical hurt to the United States. They don't have ICBMs, they don't have armies or navies. They could not hurt us if they wanted to. There has rarely been any evidence that they really wanted to. And that, in fact, is perhaps the whole point. If they had had ICBMs, we probably wouldn't have done the things to them for fear of retaliation. Cheap shots, if you will, killing people of other countries of the world who cannot defend themselves under the guise of secrecy and under the rubric of national security.
That's the game these killers play. They're killers for hire in a world for sale. It's time we pull the price tag from the world and remove them from being the merchants and owners of the planet. Slave out.